It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the career of Robin Williams in light of the news of his death yesterday.
First, we're highlighting one of the many authors who call Wisconsin home. Our next guest is an elementary school librarian from Eau Claire who looked around and couldn't find the books the kids, especially boys who weren't interested in fantasy writing but still wanted action-adventure, were looking for. So she decided to write a book herself.
The book is a historical fiction. It tells the story of Sevi Anderson, the teenage son of a Norwegian immigrant lumberjack from Eau Claire. When his dad's injured, Sevi takes up the lumberjack trade and lives the life of a 14-year-old Paul Bunyan.
Carolyn Ackervik joins us now. She's the author of White Pine, My Year as a Lumberjack and a River Rat, and she joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
Well, tell us how you first got the idea to write an adventure book about Wisconsin lumberjacks.
Well, I went with my son, my oldest son, who is now in high school, to the Chippewa Valley Museum. And we were at the Paul Bunyan logging camp, and we were sitting on the bunks, and we looked up, and there were some stinky, old, nasty socks hanging there. And my son looked at me, and he said, "Mom, why are there such stinky, nasty socks here?" And I said, "Well, you know, I have no idea." And so we started talking about asking the gentleman who was taking us around about the lumberjack lifestyle. What was it like? How did these men live? And my son really got into it. And I thought, you know, hey, this is kind of an exciting, a really vibrant period in our region's history. And as I was not from the area, it was something I really wanted to learn about.
Well, you're a librarian. You see what kids are reading, what they want to read. Did you see a need for this kind of book, one that wasn't about vampires and wizards and witches?
Very, very true. Actually, again, I went up to the young adult section in our local library, and we were looking around. And again, it was one of my boys came up to me and he said, "You know what, Mom? There's nothing here I want to read. I don't want to read about werewolves. I don't want to read about, magic." Or he wasn't a Harry Potter fan. And I thought, you know what? We do need to have fiction available for boys who want action, who want adventure. You know, in the tradition of Harry Mazer, you know, Gary Paulson, Gary Schmidt, they want characters to whom they can relate, but who really do have exciting lives. And so that's why I thought, you know, this really is an area, a genre of fiction that needs to grow. As, to be perfectly honest, boys tend to be the most reluctant of readers, generally speaking. I mean, you have boys who are strong readers, but as a general group, girls tend to be more drawn to reading fiction. And so I do think there is a need to, pursue developing fiction for reluctant readers and particularly boys.
Well, you live in Eau Claire, but as you said, you're not from Eau Claire.
Yes.
How did you get inside the history of the lumberjack industry that used to be booming there?
Well, actually, the school where I teach is right down on Half Moon Lake. And Half Moon Lake was a logging holding pen. And so there was so much rich history around me, history that I knew nothing about. Right by my school, there's Menominee Street, and that was one of the main thoroughfares in Eau Claire in the 1860s. And there was a general store there called Whiteside's, a mercantile. In addition, again, very near to my house, near the hockey rink, there was this old building, and there was a sign in front of it, a historical marker for the Daniel Shaw Lumber Company. It was the office for the lumber company. So as I started to become more aware of the history of the region, I started to see more representations of it around me. I understood the significance of the confluence of the two rivers. And once you're aware, once your eyes are opened to the history around you, you start to see a lot more of it.
And did you take any inspiration from Wisconsin's favorite lumberjack, Paul Bunyan?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Actually, I got a lot of information from the Chippewa Valley Museum, Wisconsin Historical Society, and from Paul Bunyan Logging Camp. The thing is, the thing that's really cool about lumberjacks is they really were kind of the superheroes, the WWE champions of their time and place. And, you know, they are uniquely capable, like Paul Bunyan is, of drawing young people in. I mean, these were guys who lived hard and on the edge, and they're very appealing to young readers.
Well, your main character in this book, it's a teenager, 14-year-old named Sevi Anderson, and
yes,
his father breaks a leg, and so Sevi has to take up the family responsibility and become a lumberjack when he's just 14 years old. Can you tell us some of what he goes through, some of his adventures as a boy lumberjack?
Well, first of all, he has to assume the responsibilities of a man, and that means he has to see things through to the finish, always do his very, very best, and always be aware of the situation the people around him are in. And so he has to really set aside his childish kind of, I want to do my own thing, or I don't need to think about the ramifications of everything I do. And he has to be willing to absolutely put himself in peril in order to not only accomplish his job, but to ensure the well-being of the men he works with. I mean, these men were working in, you know, sub-zero temperatures on ice, you know, high heights in the trees, you know, with these widowmaker trees falling down around them. They were living in very, very dangerous circumstances. And so Seve has to prove that he is worthy to be with these men, that he is worthy to be one of them. And along the way, he learns a lot about himself, and he also learns about, actually, about my favorite character in the story, Fabien Roget, who's kind of the pinnacle of what it means to be a lumberjack. He's Quebecois, he's a French-Canadian, and he has it all together. He is the ultimate river rat and lumberjack, and he is Seve's hero. But for some reason, he takes an instant and keen dislike to Seve. And so part of the story is Seve coming to understand Fabien and understand why he is reacting to him this way.
What surprises did you come across in terms of lumberjack culture as you researched this book?
Actually, my favorite little factoid of lumberjack culture is, and actually I learned this at the Paul Bunyan logging camp, is that when they were eating in the cook shack, no one was allowed to speak. And I was thinking, good Lord, how unpleasant would that be? You're sitting there at a table with all these people from so many different cultures. I mean, they had, you know, just so many different cultures represented there, and they weren't allowed to talk. And, they're working hard all day. I think the first thing I'd want to do is have a good chat while I was eating dinner. But the reason was, the concern was that because there were so many different cultures and languages, that conflicts would arise that would eventually erupt into fights. So the idea was, if you keep things silent at the table, people are going to eat their fill and you're not going to have any problems. And I thought that was pretty entertaining.
Yeah.
I like that. So
that's an interesting aspect. And what about the flannel and the beards and the stinky socks? True or false?
Stinky socks, most definitely. And they do present a problem for Seve later in the story. And beard, yes. I mean, if you're going outside when it's dark at 5 a.m. in the winter, I think a beard is probably a good decision. The graybacks, you know, the fleas and in their sleeping quarters, the conditions. I imagine it was a rather odoriferous experience. But I also think that there were some really, you know, unbelievable elements. I mean, there's a scene in the book, and I think anyone who's been in the Wisconsin Northwoods can picture this. You know, ice cold lake, the steam coming off the lake because the sun's coming up, loons floating around the distance. You can hear the cry of the loon, perhaps a bald eagle in the sky, and he's learning to burl. And burling is log rolling, which is a critical part of the story. And I could just, it's just that scene of that boy being taught by Johan and Ole Jensen, the two Swedish burlers, lumberjacks and river rats. That scene really resonated with me, that, you know, just the magic of the North Woods, which I was really seeking to capture, you know, the white pine forest, the beautiful lakes. And there's so much rich beauty, natural beauty in Wisconsin. And I wanted to put that into this story.
And I read that you were also a little conflicted because these were the people who deforested parts of the state. Was that a problem for you?
I try to consider myself something of a conservationist. And yes, part of the lumberjack experience is deforesting giant swaths of beautiful, you know, beautiful land. And I think there is nothing more tragic than a cutaway area. I mean, where all these magnificent, huge white pine trees have been taken down. That's sad to look at. But it's very much a part of our history. You can't judge that time period in our current context. It's not fair to the period. I did struggle with that a little bit, you know, but that's it. It's the history of the area. And I think that focusing on that part of it's losing kind of the magic and the adventure of the rest of it.
So was this the book that your sons were looking for? Did they like it?
Well, I have to let them answer it. Actually, I had a very neat experience with a third grade class reading it in Eau Claire. And what they really enjoyed was seeing the places that they grew up in, Shawtown, where the people worked who worked in the sawmills and the actual lakes. And I really appreciated how they could very much connect with this character, that they understood his feelings. And so I felt it was successful, and I also felt it really did capture the spirit of the area and the time.
Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Veronica.
We've been speaking with Carolyn Akervic. She is the author of White Pine, My Year as a Lumberjack and a River Rat. She's an elementary school librarian in Eau Claire.
We respond to the sad news yesterday of the passing of Robin Williams with a look at his career. At age 63, Williams was found dead in his California home yesterday. The suspected cause of death is suicide. Currently, there's an investigation into the official cause of death.
Williams began his career as a comedian but evolved into a versatile Academy Award-winning actor. He became known for his more serious roles in movies like The Dead Poets Society and Good Will Hunting.
And we'll take your calls throughout this conversation. What is your favorite Robin Williams role? Do you have a favorite moment from his stand-up or his many talk show appearances? Call in and share your thoughts and memories and what we've lost at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Jonathan Gray is here to talk about the career of Robin Williams. He's a professor of media and cultural studies at UW-Madison. Jonathan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start at the beginning of the career of Robin Williams, and he was first known as an alien on the popular show Mork and Mindy. Let's take a listen.
That's enough. I'll tell you what you want to know.
I don't believe you. Don't you get haircuts on Orf?
No, we tried to avoid them because of the Naga Chomps.
Naga Chomps? What's that?
It's a small green creature about this big. We put them on our heads and let them graze. They're vicious little animals. Kind of...
That sounds dangerous.
Oh, only if you fall asleep in the chair. Occasionally a maverick will get loose from the herd and run down your neck. That's why we have to set traps in our shorts.
It's still funny. I don't know. I haven't heard Mork and Mindy in a long time, but it's a good show, even today, right?
Yeah, no, I haven't watched it for a while. In fact, I forgot that it started with Happy Days, that mm-hmm. most boring of shows.
Did we know what we had then with Robin Williams as Mork? Did we get a sense of what was to come just from that early sitcom?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually you see the sort of roots of a performance that you'll see again and again throughout his movies as... You know, one of the things that's so appealing about him is his sort of childlike quality, that sort of fragility to him, and a character who's kind of all alone. And if you think that sort of carries all the way through and then gets picked up in things like Hook, where he's the sort of the boy who never grew, or who did grow old but shouldn't have grown old, and so forth.
Do you think his career, his style changed a lot over time, or is he someone who just sort of came out of the gate perfect, funny, and feeling all together at once?
Yeah, I mean, his stand-up has a very sort of explosive style, which you see throughout of a lot of his performances. But I also think that, yeah, I mean, as I was saying in response to your question about Mork, I think his style has always had that sort of fragility, a sense of loss, which I think is one of the things that makes him so likable. You know, when we meet people who are just impossibly happy and seem to, like, love everything, they're often quite annoying. Whereas I think one of the things that made sort of Robin Williams's, you know, message that he gave in a movie after movie of sort of seize the day and value it was the sense that the character and perhaps the actor was suffering from some sense of a loss. His characters often lost a family member or were aware of death on the horizon or death in the past. And right from the World According to Garp, one of his first roles, in which he's just brilliant. I mean, I still think that's probably my favorite role of his.
Watching Mork and Mindy again, I watched it regularly when I was a kid. Watching it again, looking at the other actors, they seemed to be genuinely laughing. I mean, they weren't acting necessarily, whether he was ad-libbing or not. It seemed so spontaneous that, you know, if I had been standing there, I would have reacted the same way he did. I can't think of anybody else quite like that, honestly. Can you?
No, I mean, I think of, you know, sometimes the inability of people to keep a straight face when they're on the Colbert show with Stephen Colbert. But even then, that's with a character that Colbert sort of turns on just for the show and quite often has off afterwards. Whereas you hear endless stories of people who sort of met Robin Williams in a grocery store or met him, you know, after shooting had finished and they were a crew member and how incredibly hilarious he was and or you'd be given any kind of prop and you'd do something with it.
Let's go to our phone lines right away and take Steve from Racine. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. What is your favorite Robin Williams moment?
I used to love his imitation of John Wayne playing Hamlet.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up.
I can actually kind of do it. It's not as good as Robin, but if you allow me, I'll give it a go.
All right, sure, go for it.
Is this a dagger I see before me?
Yeah, that's pretty
Macbeth.
Good.
Yeah, Macbeth.
I remember that one.
Oh, Macbeth, yeah. I'm sorry, yes. The world just somehow seems like not just a less good place without Robin Williams. It's truly sad by his loss.
That's well put. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate that. And I think, does that come from his stand-up, Jonathan?
Yeah. I mean, I think he was doing lots of impressions in his stand-up. I mean, it's hard. A lot of comedians, the stuff that's in their stand-up and appears in their movies, and you know, when you're a good improv artist, you've always got these things on the tip of your tongue. You can reuse them again, but I just remember back in the sort of early 80s when I was listening to anything I could get my hands on of his stand-up, lots of impression, lots of just sort of quick-fire humor that blended into something else. It's sort of perfect for a mash-up culture that we're now in.
Let's give a listen to just a bit of a stand-up. There was so much to choose from. Here's a clip.
This is why I had to give up alcohol, because you have to pay the next day. Pray, dear Lord, please don't hurt me now. There you are lying in bed, and you feel like the scene from the movie The Fly going, help me, help me. The entire room is spinning like a roulette wheel. Place your bets, place your bets. And there's the old toilet in the corner going, talk to me.
Well, and that's what you're talking about there exactly, Jonathan. How many characters were in just that short clip there? And I remember watching him on, you know, the Tonight Show or whatever, and he'd get on a roll, and there would be like 20 different characters speaking through him at a time.
Yeah, I mean, and so much of his the fun just came from sort of these weird juxtapositions of characters or styles you would never expect to see together. You know, John Wayne doing Hamlet, as the last caller suggested.
You know, we heard that reference to alcohol in that clip, and as we know, he struggled with addiction over the years. And some people say that there is a dark side within all comedians, and it expresses itself as comedy. Do you think that's the case here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you often find this. I think comedians, as much as we tend to think that comedians are dealing with the light side of life, they're often not. They're often exploring all sorts of dark things, because comedy is one of the only realms that we allow ourselves as a culture to discuss all sorts of taboo subjects. So, you know, when we deal with death, when we deal with sort of human fragility and frailty, when we deal with failure, we're often dealing with it in the realm of comedy. So I think almost all comedians are dealing with that at some level. I think more so in is often the case with Robin Williams's work.
Back to our callers with Justin on the line now in Milwaukee. Justin, hi.
Hi. I love the topic today, and I just wanted to share, I remembered after 9/11, for a long time it seemed like the whole country was in mourning, and there wasn't anything really funny. Like, we could get excited about sports, but we just didn't get excited about anything else. And I remember his HBO Live on Broadway special coming on, and I don't remember in the previous year, it was like 2002, I don't think I laughed that hard for a whole year before that. And I guess that's what I'll remember most, and I just wish we had gotten a little more of that before he had to go.
Thanks, Justin. Well, there's that laughter and taboo that you were talking about, Jonathan. Robin Williams was maybe the right person to tackle things and get us laughing again.
Yeah, I mean, I remind me of a story I just read yesterday that I never heard before. But you know, Robin Williams and Christopher Reeve were roommates and friends from Juilliard, and Christopher Reeve had his horrible accident and was in hospital. He talked about how Robin Williams burst in dressed as in full scrubs, using a Russian accent, saying it was time for his rectal examination, and it was the first time that he had laughed in a long, long time. And I just think that, you know, Williams's ability sort of charged through some of those moments, and comedians can do that in such a wonderful way.
Yeah, you can just imagine that moment. He must have been hilarious and a light for Christopher Reeves in that moment, too. Well, we're talking right now about the career of actor and comedian Robin Williams. We lost him yesterday. He was found dead in his home at the age of 63. We're talking with media and culture expert Jonathan Gray and taking your calls.
Yeah, we're talking with you, too. Share your favorite Robin Williams memory, your favorite Robin Williams performance with us now. Share your thoughts on what we've lost, too, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit.
We're continuing our conversation now about the career of Robin Williams with media and culture expert Jonathan Gray.
And we're taking your calls now. What is your favorite Robin Williams role, memory? What's your favorite performance? What's the favorite stand-up bit from his career? Call in and share your thoughts and memories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll give a listen to a more serious role in Robin Williams' career from Dead Poets Society.
Seize the day. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Why does the writer use these lines?
Because he's in a hurry.
No. Ding! Thank you for playing anyway. Because we are food for worms, lads. Because believe it or not, each and every one of us in this room is one day going to stop breathing, turn cold, and die.
Jonathan, alongside his comic career, Robin Williams did a bunch of very memorable, serious roles as well. Not everybody makes that transition so smoothly.
No, I mean, I think he, and right from the beginning, I mean, World According to Garp was one of the first movies he did, and it was a really serious role where he's trying to, you know, capture the spirit of one of John Irving's sort of greatest characters, and I think he really cut a path for a lot of other stand-ups, and also for people to take seriously the degree to which comic acting takes a lot of skill. And that skill could be transferred into all sorts of dramatic acting, too.
Let's go back to our phones now and take Kay in Madison. Hey, Kay.
Hi. I just am reminded of the phrase that there's a fine line between genius and insanity. It seems like some of the people that I know that have been the most creative, Robin Williams was so he moved so fast that I had to really try hard to keep up with where he was headed. But he really struggled with emotional stuff, much like Jonathan Winters, who was his mentor.
Right. Well, thank you, Kay. And Kay talking about some of the struggles that he had alongside this incredible genius, not just in comedy, but in drama as well. Do you think that maybe in some way the two informed each other, Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we can reel off a huge list of great comedians who have sort of succumbed to all sorts of sort of abusive behaviors and have suffered from depression horribly, and it's sad to see that the two are often going together. I mean, hopefully it would be a reminder to us all that, you know, not everyone who's suffering from depression walks around with a Charlie Brown cloud above their head, that sometimes they look like they're doing great when in fact that might be a symptom of what they're struggling with.
Okay, thanks for the call. We'll go to Brady in Menominee now. Brady, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I really just wanted to share my fondest memory of Robin Williams. Growing up as a child, I remember waking up to my father would blast track number one on the Good Morning Vietnam soundtrack. I don't know if you've heard it, but it goes a little something like this. Good morning, Vietnam. This is not a test. Just wonderful memories there, and that certainly got me out of bed. So,
Brady, thanks.
Thank you.
What a great memory to share. And Jonathan, that seems like a role made for Robin Williams. He got to do the comedy in that movie. He got to do all the characters. And yet it was a very serious and poignant movie as well. That one, to me, really brought it all together.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to find a movie where both his comic chops and his dramatic chops are working so wonderfully in tandem. I mean, I should say, I think my father woke me up many times with the exact same phrase.
Since this is radio, I'm really struck fresh with his voice. There's something about his voice. There's the way that it rings out. And he was an actor who was able to do just voice work as well. I'm thinking about how he played the genie in Aladdin. And I wonder if we could, let's take a listen to that and then think about, you know, the incredible gift of just his voice.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, I mean, this
I'm your master?
That's right. He can be taught. What would you wish of me?
The ever impressive.
The long contained. But never duplicated. Genie of the lamp.
Wow. How does he do that? It's like there's 10 different voices in there, Jonathan.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. I mean, it's also important to remember that one of the legacies that Robin Williams carries on is that, I mean, he really kicked off the era of this sort of celebrity casting for voice casting for animated films. I mean, his role as Genie and Aladdin really sort of and his legal struggles with Disney to be fully remunerated opened up a new era in voice acting for film and for animated film in particular.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Lynn on the line in Black River Falls. Lynn, hi.
Hi. I was just calling because I actually got a brief encounter with Robin Williams when I actually worked security of the set What Dreams May Come. And in the morning, he would come by and always say good morning and ask you how you were. And when he asked you how you were, he was just so sincere and actually wanted to know. And he was always just so pleasant. And the vibrant blue eyes were just so stunning.
Lynn, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Jonathan, I understand you briefly met Robin Williams.
Yeah, very briefly. Nothing sort of celebrated. I was working at the University of California, Berkeley. I had just gone to see a talk from George Soros. And as I was filing out of the auditorium, I realized the man in front of me in line was Robin Williams. So I tapped him on the shoulder and said I really liked his work. And, I mean, he looked me straight in the eye. He was just sort of, you know, appreciative. He clearly wasn't on and didn't really want to be recognized, so he was keeping his voice low, but very appreciative. You know, I mean, I lived in London for a while and would often go and talk to actors when they came out of the theater, and, you know, more often than not, they don't give you the time of day. And it was just nice to see a sort of genuine moment from a person who just sort of wanted to engage with another human being.
Jonathan, is there a favorite role that you have from Robin?
Yeah, I mean, I said it earlier, but I think World According to Garp, I'd almost go right back to the beginning. I think he did a lot of great roles, but there's something sort of beautiful about that character, very melancholy. I've been thinking about it a lot today because Garp is sort of always doomed from the beginning, and in the wake of the news that, you know, Mr. Williams had killed himself, it seems sort of fitting in a horrible way. It's just a sort of beautiful study of you know, what are the moments and the places in our life where we can make a difference and we make things better for people.
Back to the phones now with Eric on the line in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I just wanted to say one of my favorite roles of Robin Williams, and it hasn't been mentioned yet, but he was in Death to Smoochie with Edward Norton, and he played kind of the antagonist there. And there's one scene where it's two kids show hosts, and it's a off-screen battle with them. But they end up in the rafters of a stadium, and he falls out and lands on the field, and everybody comes running over to him, and they say, Rainbow, are you okay? And he looks at him and says, well, I'm pretty messed up in general, so it's kind of hard to gauge.
Eric, thanks. Jonathan, a versatile career for Robin Williams. Can you leave us with a couple thoughts?
Yeah, no, I mean, he really owned the sort of a particular decade from sort of like, you know, the 80s into the 90s. He stars alongside some of the more celebrated actors of our time and often outshines them, not only in his comic ability, but also in acting ability. I think he made a lot of people laugh and also made a lot of people think about the sort of value of life, and hopefully the news about his passing would do the same.
Jonathan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
for having me.
Jonathan Gray leaves us now, professor at UW-Madison. We'll still go with some of your memories with Robin Williams at 800-642-1234. I think we'll still listen to a clip from Mrs. Doubtfire in a minute, too. Anna in La Crosse is on the line. Anna, hi there.
Hi there. I just wanted to comment that when we heard the news, my husband and I, our jaws both dropped. Good Will Hunting, to me especially, was a very formative movie for me. It came out right when I was starting to blossom as a teenager, and it actually made me realize that everyone has their own unique qualities, and as a matter of fact, encouraged me to seek some therapy myself and really helped me along. I have always appreciated Robin Williams as an actor.
Anna,
now I feel even closer to him.
Anna, thank you so much for sharing those thoughts.
Yeah, and interesting to hear how art affects real life, how the lives of people and the art that they do can have a ripple effect right into people's actual day-to-day lives. So interesting. Thank you, Anna. And we're going to go next to Debbie in Menominee. Hi, Debbie.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
One of my favorite Robin Williams movies is Patch Adams. It's based on a true story about an individual that ended up becoming a doctor. But in the story, I mean, all of Robin Williams' talents as a comedian just come through because there's really some serious things in it, but there's also a lot of happiness and making people happy. He's a doctor. He's going to medical school, and he sneaks into the hospital to see the patients, and he's entertaining the kids in the children's ward. There's a part in the movie where there is a gentleman that is dying of cancer, and Robin, and he's struggling with the whole process, the patient. And Robin goes in, and he's just trying to break through and be with that individual as a hospice. It's a great movie. It's one of my favorite ones that he was in.
Debbie, thanks a lot for the call. What do you say we go out with a clip from Mrs. Doubtfire?
Absolutely.
All right.
Can I help you, man?
Oh, sorry I'm late. But after all those scotches, I had to like a racehorse.
Daniel?
Yeah?
Why in God's name are you dressed like a woman?
Well, I'd like you to meet the host of your new show.
Host?
Euphigenia Doubtfire, dear. I specialize in the education and entertainment of children.
Robin
Williams. Surprise.
Robin Williams as Mrs. Doubtfire. As we talk about the past of Robin Williams and his career, you can continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. It's time for Teach Me What You Know. It's almost back to school time, and a lot of parents are going to find themselves with empty nests, maybe for the first time ever. It's a time of transition for kids and parents, and our guest today has advice for empty nesters on how to cope when the kids leave. Jim Wozner joins us now. He's a professor and dean of the Illinois School of Professional Psychology at Argosy University, Schaumburg. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So a lot of parents feel sad when their kids leave. Is it okay to just go with that feeling?
Absolutely. I mean, I think parents need to realize that this is kind of a normal process, a normal developmental reaction to a life cycle change in the family, and that it's normal to feel some sadness, to feel some loss. I think the only time you need to be very concerned if it's so severe that it seems to interfere with your daily life, or it seems to go on for a number of months and other people begin to get concerned about it, then you probably need to talk to a doctor or a mental health professional, because it may be a sign of some more underlying depression or more serious difficulty in dealing with this change.
Well, short of that, with the more predictable level of sadness, how can parents begin to get out of that that sadness cycle and loss and start moving forward?
That's a great question. I think the start is just to realize, first of all, that it's a normal process that all parents, and particularly parents in this day and age, go through. Because I think often people begin to think that there must be something wrong with me. Why am I having such a difficult time with it? So realize that it's normal and be willing to, first of all, I think, to talk with friends, relatives, family about your feelings and sort of, again, recognize that it's a normal process. Secondly, I think it's important to think about that this is not only a sense of a time of loss, but it's also an opportunity. It's an opportunity to begin to do a variety of things that you haven't had a chance to because you've been so busy parenting, whether it's pursuing hobbies, returning to school, traveling, reconnecting with old friends or siblings. So there really is a lot of potential in terms of adding things to your life, even though it may feel at that time to be sort of painful and sad.
Right. As a parent with college or leaving home some years off, I still wonder, what the heck would I do to fill all the time that's, you know, that goes to kid-related functions? What is a good place to start looking? How can we start harnessing that and move it in a positive direction?
Well, I think one of the things that I would do is and I think this has to start before the event, right, before it happens. So I would begin to be thinking about what are the kinds of things that you've wanted to do. Some people talk about it as a bucket list. Others think about what are the goals that I've want to accomplish yet. Most parents are still relatively young with our sort of expanded lifespan. And so, you know, there's a time to do these things. So I would begin to sort of think about what are the different things you've wanted to do in your life. And sometimes this includes sort of hobbies, whether it's painting or music. Other times it's returning to school. The other thing, though, is there's a lot of research that suggests that parents who are, you know, empty nesters seem to really often build a lot of deeper relationships with family, particularly with their siblings, than they didn't before, because now they have a chance to sort of reconnect, reconnect with old friends. So I think those are all sort of opportunities that you can look forward to. But it does probably require a little bit of planning and thinking ahead. What do I want to do now that I have this time available?
I've heard that one thing that can be surprising for couples is they don't necessarily know how to relate to each other without a kid around. How do they start to adjust to that new family dynamic?
Absolutely, Rob. In fact, this is a quite a stressful time for many couples. In the number of years that I've been doing family therapy, that's usually one of the high risk periods for many couples, largely because they're so used to just relating to each other as parents and as co-parents that they've often let a lot of the normal kinds of activities that brought them together as a romantic couple let them go. I mean, they're more focused now on the day-to-day. They've been focused for decades on the day-to-day tasks of how to raise their kids and develop a family life. So one of the things I think couples need to do is to, just like I talked about in terms of thinking about what does the individual want to do with their life, they need to begin to think about what does our relationship need for the future. They need to start to rethink about, well, now what kind of couple do we want to be? What are things that we want to do together? What are things that we haven't done? What are things that we need to explore? At times when there is a conflict that emerges or people feel that, wow, we don't seem to have much in common anymore, then I think it's important to kind of, in a more focused way, maybe work on some of those issues. It's not a bad time to maybe find a couples therapist to work on some of these issues, particularly if you're having difficulties. But I think the key thing is that this is an opportunity, but it probably will take some time. It's almost like the couple is beginning to know each other again, or certainly begin to reconnect in ways that they haven't done for years.
Well, another relationship that changes at that point is the one between the parents and the kid. It used to be somebody living under their roof, under their care. Now it's somebody living somewhere else and in charge of themselves. How do you start making the future of that relationship.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So one of the things I think is it's important to keep the lines of communication open. I think kids, when they go away to college in particular, have so many things that they get busy with and new friends and new activities, and they may not connect with parents very often, and I think that can be very difficult with parents. So one of the things that I recommend to them is before the child leaves, talk about how often you're going to contact each other, set regular times, whether it's a Sunday evening call. Often it's important that that this is sort of planned and it's a regular kind of activity. Just like parents often may have regular dinners at home when the kids are there, when they're away, I think it's okay to have regular communication. I think the other thing is this is an opportunity for parents to really begin to get to know their children and their emerging adult lives. So, you know, it's okay to ask questions about, you know, how courses are going or what's going on in their lives, realizing that they may not be sharing everything with you. But I think many parents feel hesitant to want to talk with their kids about these things. But my experience is that most children ultimately do want to share these things with their parents. It may take a little while as they kind of feel out this new changing relationship.
As we wrap up, if there are kids listening, getting ready to go off to school in the fall, anything they can do to make life easier for the folks?
That's great. Well, I think, first of all, be sure to contact them periodically. And secondly, you know, realize that lives are going to be emerging too. Sometimes the kids have as hard a time with this as the folks. Realize this is a great opportunity for both of them to develop a new and deeper relationship. You know, as one door closes, another door is opening with all kinds of possibilities, both for individual growth in the terms of parents and for a new and interesting relationship and deeper relationship ultimately between children and their parents.
Great place to leave it. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Pleasure talking with you.
That was Jim Wozner. He's a professor and dean of the Illinois School of Professional Psychology at Argosy University, Schaumburg.